I have nothing. As usual.
Hi, everybody, and welcome to Maintenance Phase, the podcast that has nothing.
We're just sitting in silence. You can hear my fingernails tapping on the table for like 45 minutes. That's what we're doing.
I did kind of spring it on you, you know? I put you on the spot.
Okay, what do I have? Welcome to Maintenance Phase, the podcast that comes to you with weighted blankets.
Oh.
Because that was somebody's question. That was like a really lovely question.
Wait, who asked us about weighted blankets?
They asked us how we get cozy to settle in for a long research session. Oh, no, they said a Snuggie, not a weighted blanket.
Either one, I'm down.
I wish I wasn't a Snuggie all the time now.
I'm Aubrey Gordon.
I'm Michael Hobbs.
Hey, everybody, we're doing an AMA. Thank you all so much for your questions.
Yeah, we got so many.
Yeah, so we announced last month that this month's bonus episode is a bunch of AMA questions, and you all had so many
delivered.
You had so many.
The people had questions.
Mike, where would you like to start?
I thought this was a really interesting question. In the past 5 years, I became one of those people who was fat and then dropped all the weight. Mm. I believe before, Aubrey, you've pointed out how too often those of us who were fat and then lost weight end up being the biggest bullies to fat individuals. Any advice you can give to us in this crowd?
I would say, just to be really clear, anti-fatness exists in every kind of person with every kind of body. Like, there's not like a kind of person who is free of anti-fatness, because there aren't pockets of the world that are free from anti-fatness. Right. But there's something about the process of like major significant weight loss from formerly fat people that calls upon them to do something that is sometimes referred to by sociologists and social psychologists as social distancing. It's a different version of social distancing. It's a different use of that term.
Yeah.
The idea is that you want to create distance between yourself and an undesirable group of people. And that's part of what happens with when fat people lose weight, is that there is like a bunch of pressure to renounce other fat people.
Yeah.
I would say the pressure is the problem. People succumbing to the pressure is a very understandable human thing. It's not fucking great, but it's very understandable and human. Mm-hmm. I mean, I feel like some of the ways that that pressure shows up is that, like, you know, I think just on the face of it, congratulations for weight loss is one of the ways that that pressure shows up, right?
Yeah.
And people expecting you to report out on what did you do and why did it work and how hard did you stick with it and how tenacious were you, right? That like people start looking at your body differently and using that as a reason to look at your character differently. And that's problematic and fucked up, right? Mm-hmm. I think a lot of it has to do with two things. One is, how do you navigate the narrative around your own weight loss? And I will say, what I would love to see from formerly fat people is when weight loss compliments come up, when people ask them about their weight loss and how did they do it and all that sort of stuff, being honest about like, I did things in a really unhealthy way, or I'm the exception here, not the rule,
right?
Or I did something that's not accessible to most people,
right?
Whatever the case may be, like actually contextualizing your experience instead of just uncritically accepting praise, because that praise, like the other end of that praise is, you know, it's carrot for you and it's stick for people who are still fat, right?
Right. And you can talk about your own experience as without universalizing it. I feel like so much of the stigma from former fat people comes from this idea that like, well, I stopped eating carbs and so you just need to stop eating carbs, as if like the person you're talking to hasn't tried that, hasn't considered it, or like, oh, it's just calories in, calories out. Like, thank you, Chad, for being the first person ever to tell me that. Like, a lot of this just comes from like a fundamental lack of interest in other people, or like this idea that if something works for you and your body, it must work for everybody else and they need to know about it.
I think most of the people who ask about weight loss methods are also not particularly interested.
Well, you think so?
I kind of think so. Yeah. I think once in a blue moon, someone's actually looking for tips. And most of the time, I think people are sort of adhering to this social script of like, I noticed that you've lost weight, and now the questions I'm supposed to ask you are, how did you do it? How do you feel? Yeah. And how much do you love it? Right. Like, those are the questions. Ta-da. And we don't really do a lot of thinking about like, why am I asking those questions? What are the, you know, like what message does that send? All that kind of stuff. I mean, the other thing that I would say is, so like part of it is about how you tell this, how and whether, frankly, you tell the story of your own weight loss. And I think the other thing is to like actually be in a pretty constant state of seeking feedback from fat people in your life and just asking them for like, how do you need me to show up for you? I did this last time. Was that okay? Did that feel okay to you? The last time somebody gave you shit for being a fat person? Like, what do you want me to do if a server mixes up our orders and assumes that you ordered a salad and I ordered nachos?
Right.
That's happened to me exactly one time that I've had a friend lose weight and be like, I feel really weird about this and I'm not sure how to handle it.
Oh, okay.
I'd love your input.
Do you remember what you told them in that conversation?
I do. What I told them for myself was I was like, I need you to be honest about how you lost weight. Mm-hmm. And I need you to be honest if part of your reasons for losing weight were to not look fat and to not be associated with fat people. I was like, I need you to be honest about that too.
Mm-hmm.
It's uncomfortable, but I need you to at least do me the favor of not, you know, misrepresenting it. Because I've also had friends who lost weight and have just been like, I did it for vanity. And I'm like, all right.
Yeah.
Fine. Because again, at least it's honest, right? At least it's honest. I think the stuff that smarts the most to me as a fat person is like how fucking heavily people are judging fat people all the time and then will insist on cloaking it in euphemisms. Mm-hmm. I think the stuff that hurts is partly the judgment, and the denial of the judgment for me hurts so much more.
Right.
When people are like, I would never. And I'm like, just fucking own up to it. And then we can have a conversation about it.
Yeah.
That's the stuff that feels hardest to me. And that's the stuff that really rears its head when formerly fat people lose a lot of weight.
There's also a thing where these conversations of like, oh, you used to lose weight, like oftentimes get very quickly into like carb counts and calories and, you know, how many days a week were you exercising and stuff. You can also try to keep those conversations focused on like stigma too. And like, oh, I've noticed how much nicer people are to me now that I'm thin. And like, you can do things to sort of raise awareness as well of just like, one of the reasons that's super hard to be fat is because everyone treats you like shit.
Yeah. And I think the tricky thing there is to land it in a way that doesn't then read as lending credence to major weight loss as solution to that thing. Right. Yeah. So like, totally. Yes. You should be like, it's really wild to me that it's like so much easier to get healthcare and all this stuff that didn't bother my healthcare provider before is now like a cause for concern and I'm getting treatment for it or whatever.
Right.
Then you gotta say the quiet part loud, right? You gotta say, and it shouldn't be that way. And that's why it's really important to me that everyone gets good healthcare regardless of their size and that other people shouldn't have to like continue to sort of put themselves in this punishing grist mill of like, horrible weight loss shit.
I've noticed as a thin person that other thin people think that I'm like safe to make fat jokes to. Like, I am the wrong fucking person to do that with. Like, I am not a safe space for that shit. Like, I was at a dinner thing once and somebody mentioned some, he saw some fat person from across the room and he made some mean comment. And I was like, oh, do you know her? And he's like, no. And I was like, oh, well, you just said something about her health. Because if you don't know her, why would you be commenting on her? And I just played dumb for like 15 minutes. What's her first name? And yet you're commenting on her heart attack risk and you don't know her first name. Interesting.
Are you a doctor who can tell the future? That's how you know she's going to have a heart attack? Oh, interesting.
Have you been speaking to a spirit from the year 3535? Because that's an interesting choice.
I really love it when you use your reply guy powers for good.
It doesn't happen often.
It makes me really, really happy. Okay, are you ready for a question?
Oh, yeah, let's do it.
Michael, you've mentioned you're a PK, pastor's kid. How do you feel like that's shaped you as a journalist?
I feel like I never have the answer that people want on this one.
Is it one that you've been asked before?
Yeah, people ask me this a lot because I mentioned that I grew up in like a very religious household. And I think people imagine a like Christian fundamentalist household or Westboro Baptist Church, something along those lines. And so the house that I grew up in, my parents are very religious, but they're like Seattle Presbyterians. So like my mom has a degree in biology. My dad was a university professor when I was growing up.
What was he a professor of?
Dentistry, dental school professor.
Whoa, okay.
My parents are actually one of my arguments for like people not getting carried away.
Mm.
I think there's like an anti-religious kind of thing on the left, right? This we believe in science stuff can start to feel kind of anti-religious. People are just like kind of mean to people whose religious beliefs are very important to them. And so I have, of course, seen like the way that organized Christianity can be like a really toxic force politically. But on a personal level, I've also seen that it's like a really great source of meaning and morality in my parents' lives. Mm. I left organized religion very young. I was like 13, basically as soon as I figured out I was gay. Mm. I was like, this is a weird boner. I don't want to go to church anymore. Like that was my journey. I was like, this is not it.
I'm making a t-shirt, but only for you. It will not be for sale broadly. That just says that.
Extremely problematic.
This is a weird boner. I don't want to go to church anymore. So wait, was your dad was a dentistry lecturer, like mm-hmm. professor of dentistry and also a pastor?
My mom was a pastor.
Your mom was the pastor. There we go.
Sexist. Wow. Aubrey.
Wow. The doctor was a
the
woman.
The doctor was a woman? Wow. From my own podcast co-host, I can't believe it, Aubrey.
I never anticipated. I expected so much better from you.
I have one for you.
Tell me.
It says, could you talk about gender performance, straightness, queerness, and fatness? I've been reflecting so much in the last year on this, and they feel extremely connected, but I can't work out how. And then somebody left a reply that said, fashion for fat people is also super heavily gendered in a way straight size fashion isn't.
Okay. I'm going to offer like extremely bargain basement insights into this.
Okay.
What I will say that I have been thinking about recently in particular is how much my fatness has shaped what kinds of gender expression are available to me at what points. Mm. As a fat kid in high school, the options that were available were like Lane Bryant and Catherine's and then like the Nordstrom plus size section, mm-hmm. all of which were like business casual for like, so you work an office job and you want to kick back on Friday.
Oh, yeah.
I didn't want to be a teenager in Portland in the late 90s wearing like business casual, whatever. Like, yeah. That's rough.
Yeah.
So the other option that was available to me was men's clothes. So I spent a bunch of high school wearing like army surplus clothes. I wore my brother's old like Carhartts. I had a bunch of like contractors, sort of like hammer loop jeans, reinforced jeans. I wore a bunch of t-shirts, just plain t-shirts, because men's sizes offered larger sizing than women's sizes. Mm-hmm. To this day, I would say most of my t-shirts are quote unquote men's cuts, because those are what's available to me. And then when I hit college, Torrid became available, which is like a plus size store in the US. And at the time, it was an offshoot of Hot Topic. So the options that were available to me were this like very, at that point, were this very specific, like high femme rockabilly kind of look.
Okay.
Polka dot halter neck dresses and that kind of thing. So I wore that for a while because that was what was available. But it was really like at every point, any kind of expression of my gender was shaped first by what was available to me, which was extremely fucking limited.
Yeah.
And then it would be like, okay, you have two choices. You can dress in men's clothes or you can dress like a middle-aged woman, which I am now. And I'm happy to, you know, apprise myself of those options. Great.
And now you want those business casual looks.
Oh,
you've circled back around.
Give it to me.
You want khakis.
Yes.
Do you think you would have dressed in like girlier clothes if they were available as a teenager?
Yeah, I was super into Riot Girl.
Oh, yeah.
I was super duper into Riot Girl. And there was just nothing, like I would go thrift shopping. And the only things that were available to me in thrift shopping world were like men's clothing. So I ended up wearing a bunch of like bowling shirts and shit. It's real cursed late 90s look that I was going for.
It's so frustrating because it's like clothing is so important to the way that you express yourself and the way that other people perceive you. Mm-hmm. People at that time must have been seeing you as like, yeah, the kind of person who's like really into wearing Carhartt stuff. That isn't necessarily who you were. That's just like what was available.
Yeah, totally. And I would say I came out at a time and a place when like almost everybody I knew was straight. I was like one of the only out kids at my school and had really limited exposure to like queer people and queer media and all that kind of stuff. And all I was really seeing were like butch femme options for queer ladies. So I was like, well, I got to pick one of these too.
Yeah.
Right.
When did you come out?
I came out when I was 15.
Oh, wow. That's young.
It was really tough.
Yeah.
It would have been 1998. And the reaction was mostly like I was at a school that was seen as being progressive and like really good on social issues, and they were really bad on this.
Oh.
So like we did some organizing, me and other students, to try and like set up or revive the school's Gay Straight Alliance at that time. And the response we got from the school was, we don't need that because we're really good on those issues, from like a straight teacher. And it was like a bunch of like queer kids and one trans kid who are all like, but no, you're not. Like, yeah. We're telling you, no, you're not.
That's that good Pacific Northwest bigotry.
We couldn't. We're too good for that. Yeah. We didn't do it. We're better.
Exactly.
Than that.
They're like, no. This is fixed.
Which is also how we are on fat stuff, frankly.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. That's what I would say. It was rough. It was weird and rough. And it was rough not because people were necessarily bad on LGBT stuff, but because they thought they couldn't be.
Right.
So they couldn't take feedback. They couldn't like have a present conversation because they were all up in their defensiveness the whole time.
Hmm.
Which meant it was really hard to like get support.
Right. And then you have to do so much more work.
Well, yeah. And it just turns into me comforting them that they're not fucked up. Right.
Yeah, that's dark.
It's sort of like what they're looking for. And it's, again, like I would say, very similar to many of the interactions I have now around fat stuff, which is like people want to be reassured that they're not fucking it up. And I would like to provide that reassurance, but also sometimes they are fucking it up.
Yeah. So returning to this thing about how fashion for fat people is heavily gendered.
Yes.
What does that mean to you?
Basically, I think in fashion world, we're still in this mode. And this would be a good question to ask someone who's like more in fashion world and is not wearing a sweatshirt and leggings every single time we record.
Yeah, but your makeup is always on point.
Sure.
Your makeup is like
full
really
face of makeup
good.
Just for funsies, because I know I'm going to be on Zoom and I know I'm going to be on Zoom with Mr. Beauty YouTube, Michael Hobbs.
Who is in sweats and like has no effort on my looks whatsoever.
Look, we're a couple of fashion plates over here and you should listen to us for all your personal styling needs.
Icons.
No, we're in this place with sort of like, at least with mainstream retailers, I would say, where like you can sort of have your gender expression or you can have your size.
Right.
So for example, Old Navy now of all goddamn places has a gender neutral section. It does not include plus sizes.
Nice.
Womp womp. There's just like a bunch of stuff like that that is really, really shaping the options that are available to fat people. And also like, listen, man, at a bunch of like, you know, plus size clothing outlets, a bunch of the designers are also not fat people.
Yeah.
Also, like, even just the plus size clothes that are getting made that are, you know, not offering a lot of like gender diversity in how, you know, you're able to express. Even that stuff is also just often made badly. Like, I was talking to a friend recently and was saying that I got something from a brand that had recently expanded to include plus sizes, which is always a real dodgy time as a fat person to buy clothes, is when a brand has just expanded. And this brand did a weird thing that a lot of brands have done, which is like they didn't really get how to make plus size clothes. So they just made everything bigger.
Oh.
So like the wrist opening for the sleeve on this top was like huge. Like stuff like that where you're like, oh, you didn't. Got it.
They pointed the like Honey I Shrunk the Kids ray at all the clothes and just like set it to like embiggen. And then that's very funny.
I mean, it's just like shit like that, right? Where you're just like, okay. So like that's the other thing that I would say about all of this clothes stuff is just like, dear people who are not fat, who do not wear plus sizes, who are listening to this, it is so wonderful that you want to shop at size inclusive places. I would like for you to know and understand that that is for you, not for us. Because if it were for us, the clothes would be made in a way that fit us.
Yeah.
They would be offered in a larger size range. It wouldn't just be a handful of things are offered in plus sizes. It would be really everything is offered in plus sizes. Plus sizes would be stocked in such a way that they didn't sell out immediately.
Right.
Right. Like, there are just like all of these things that would be different if it was sort of being done for the benefit of fat people. But instead, it's being done for the benefit, I would argue, of thin people to feel like they're shopping at a place that feels more inclusive to them.
Right.
Whether or not they actually see fat people there, whether or not the clothes actually work for fat people, all that kind of stuff.
That's another thing. I follow enough fat people on Twitter to know that stores will do the like, we're inclusive now, and they'll have like the plus size models and whatever. And then like they don't even sell clothes that fit the models in their own ads. Like, it's just pure bullshit.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think like there have been a number of like extremely, extremely exclusive, like couture houses even, that have done runway shows and used models like Velvet D'Amour and Beth Ditto and other like fat and very fat models, and, you know, don't stock more than a size 8.
Right. Right.
Cool.
They wanted like 2 days of headlines is what they wanted. Yeah. They didn't actually want to make clothes for fat people.
They wanted a Law and Order rip from the headlines fashion show.
Yeah.
Okay. So we talked about clothes. We're going to shift gears now to a favorite topic of yours and mine, which is internet kerfuffle.
Yes, we love it. I think I know the question you're going to ask.
This is a bit out of left field, but I would give anything for this podcast to be around when the I love my curvy wife guy was a hot topic back in 2017. Apparently, he's still up to shenanigans, and I would love to hear any input. Y'all are the best. I'm unaware of shenanigans.
Current shenanigans?
Do you know about any of the shenanigans? I don't.
So, okay, this is like the only one that I did research on for this episode.
Oh, I can't wait.
For people who are not aware of Curvy Wife Guy, I think we should just like recap what exactly happened. So this is the original post.
Oh, there we go.
I'm 100% sure that you remember this.
So this is an Instagram post of two people who present to me as thin people, honestly. I'm just going to be upfront there. They're standing on the beach. He's wearing shorts and a muscle tee, and she's wearing a strapless one piece. They look like straight white people who are very much in love.
Yeah. If you saw it in another context, you'd be like, that's just like a nice photo.
Yeah, totally.
It's like a nice couple doing nice couple stuff. They seem very enamored with each other.
Sure. Yes. I could see that one or both of them might describe themselves as members of Bachelor Nation.
You recognize your people.
Like, oh, God.
You're like, oh, they know the rap lyrics.
First. Oh, also, the photo has 45,000 likes on it.
It's so long.
So this thing went viral in a big way if you were not paying attention to this particular internet kerfuffle in 2017. The husband in this couple posted this picture with this caption. I love this woman and her curvy body. As a teenager, I was often teased by my friends for my attraction to girls on the thicker side, ones who were shorter and curvier, girls that the average basic bro might refer to as chubby or even fat. Then, as I became a man and started to educate myself on issues such as feminism and how the media marginalizes women by portraying a very narrow and very specific standard of beauty, thin, tall, lean, I realized how many men have bought into that lie. For me, there is nothing sexier than this woman right here. Thick thighs, big booty, cute little side roll, etc. Her shape and size won't be the one featured on the cover of Cosmopolitan, but it's the one featured in my life and in my heart. There's nothing sexier to me than a woman who is both curvy and confident. This gorgeous girl I married fills out every inch of her jeans and is still the most beautiful one in the room. God, I just want to barf. Guys, rethink what society has told you that you should desire. A real woman is not a porn star or a bikini mannequin or a movie character. She's real. She has beautiful stretch marks on her hips and cute little dimples on her booty. Girls, don't ever fool yourself by thinking you have to fit a certain mold to be loved and appreciated. There is a guy out there who is going to celebrate you for exactly who you are. Someone who will love you like I love my Sarah.
What do you think? I don't remember you. I don't remember you weighing in on this at the time, but I know that you had thoughts.
I didn't say anything about it at the time because I was just like, what is there? I mean, like, the internet had all the reactions, right? I think there are people for whom this was a helpful thing to read. I think those people are not fat people.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
This is so completely over the top, weirdly self-congratulatory for like being in love with someone who's not Heidi Klum.
Yeah.
It's so uncomfortable. And it also, like, just as a fat person, I'm like, what a cool way to make your wife seem like kind of a charity case.
I know. That's what
it's
that's
so gross.
What
it's so
gets
gross.
Me. It's like, she might not be on Cosmo, but I'm into her. I don't want people to tell me that, like, they're weird for being attracted to me. I want them to tell me that I'm attractive.
Yeah, this is a very common compliment that I will say I get quite a bit. People being like, I don't care what other people say. I think you're hot. And I'm like, why?
Oh my God. You can just say you're hot. Just say you're hot.
Just say you're hot. What? No, thank you.
This story is like such a fucking journey. So I did the like date time and date thing on Google. And so he posts this January 31st, 2017, right? There's a week of fawning coverage because this post goes viral. There's like a certain type of person who's like, oh, this was really sweet, and start sharing it. So as this photo is getting more traction, there's a BuzzFeed article with the headline, "People are applauding this man for celebrating his wife's curves on the internet, semicolon, I'm not crying, you're crying."
Ugh.
And then there's one on the Today Show that says, "Husband pens body positive note to curvy wife and everyone swooning." So it's like everyone loves this like wonderful post. But then, of course, it gets to Twitter. Like people on Twitter, like, of course, people start screen grabbing it and are like, what the fuck is this? And start posting it on Twitter. And like Twitter is much meaner than other internet platforms. And it's also like a lot smarter, I think, and a lot more like countercultural. So then there's now these like compilations of like the day the internet turned on curvy wife guy.
Here. I just sent you. So I did you get it?
Wait, what? This one. I was going to send this to you, but I was like, this is too much.
You know, I clicked on the post that you sent and then it does the thing that's like, here are some other posts from this person's feed. And it is so much. It looks like he's like promoting hip hop singles.
Yeah.
And he's got a lot of like posing with butts.
He's really into his curvy wife.
And there's another person on here who's not his curvy. There's a few pictures that are like other like curvy wife body types, but not his curvy wife.
A lot of curvy ladies.
Here's not his curvy wife. It's all the same pose. It's all a lady crouching down so you can see her butt, and then him being like, look at this butt.
Man, how does she do that in heels? Holy shit.
His Instagram bio says, pre-order. Wait, hang on. Where is it? I gotta scroll back up to the top.
Don't click on the link tree. I just clicked on the link tree.
I don't want
to. Don't click on the link tree. He has like, he's like releasing singles and stuff, I guess.
Yeah. The most recent one that he's promoting in his bio is a single called Big Girl Banger. Like, no.
I know.
Ugh. Okay. I'm closing out of this Instagram window because it's
dark.
Mesmerized by terrible things.
Well, this is kind of part of my complex thoughts on this, actually.
Mm.
You know, from the roughly 80 hours of podcasts that I produced on my complicated thoughts on quote unquote cancel culture.
Yep.
It makes me feel weird when we have these things, when essentially random private citizens get the internet's attention and there's like this big wave of criticism. Usually it's fairly deserved, but it's oftentimes very disproportionate to what that person has actually done.
Uh-huh.
And what's really interesting about this kind of case is that it's one of the few quote-unquote cancellations that seems to have only resulted in positive outcomes for everyone involved.
Mm.
So one of the main reasons I feel so weird about private citizens becoming the targets of these kinds of internet mobs is because oftentimes people like lose their jobs and it results in, you know, material detriments to people's lives, right?
Yeah.
But in this case, both this guy and his wife are both internet influencers. He is some sort of like musician something. She is a plus size fashion influencer. And both of them seem to have like gained a whole lot of notoriety and business from this. So it's this very weird and rare instance of a internet cancellation where there's really been no negative effects. Like this is one of the only ones that like doesn't make me feel weird.
Yeah. I mean, it feels like the backlash had much more to do with how his post was lifted up as like, this is wonderful,
yeah,
right?
That
the backlash came from like a bunch of other people being like, it's not actually like, it's not the worst thing that's ever happened, but it's not fucking wonderful.
Yeah, it's not, I'm not crying, you're crying.
Yeah, and it's definitely not like, hey, other dudes, do what this dude is doing.
Yeah, exactly.
Sort of the vibe that I remember around the coverage was just like, we need more men like this. And I'm like, no, we don't, because
no, we really
like,
don't.
Ultimately, this is like a cishet dude being like, congratulations, you've made it. I'm attracted to you.
Right.
I really get rankled by this sort of like, fat people are okay because we're desirable stuff.
Yeah, I know.
Because it ignores a lot of fucking complexity about the ways in which folks are socialized not to date fat people, not to find fat people attractive. Like, it's a really, really complicated issue and really complex. And this is like yet another way of talking about it in a way that centers fucking thin people.
Yeah, exactly. Of like, congratulate me for this.
We're talking about this fucking dude's boner, right? Like, okay. Like, I just don't care enough about what gives dudes a boner.
Yeah. It's like, I feel like he never would have gotten the backlash if he just posted a bunch of photos with his like fairly conventionally attractive wife being like, look how hot my wife is.
Yeah. Without being like, I love my curvy wife.
Yeah.
No, there's no reason. I mean, like, so the other thing to say here is like, we're talking about this in general terms. I would say for many, many fat people, particularly fat people who have dated thin, straight dudes.
Yeah.
Have had this experience of like going out with someone way more into your body than they are into you or who you are. And they start treating you as a body instead of a person. And it's so gross and so upsetting, especially when your body has been a magnet for negative attention for so long. It can feel really, really disorienting and fucking straight up scary to have someone treat you that way. And sometimes there are plenty of dudes who like cross a fuck ton of lines based on that attraction. And so I think that will also embolden a lot of like bad actors to do more bad actor shit.
Right.
Like these kinds of conversations will embolden those guys and also will bring up all this like really hard shit for fat people too.
Yeah.
You know, so like that's the other thing is like if you have been a fat person who's dated a guy like this and felt like you were being reduced to your body all the time, seeing it congratulated so many times by other people who are less fat than you or not fat at all feels so shitty. It feels like they're all being like, yes, good job. You should have more of these like horrible experiences with horrible dudes who treat you like not a person. It just felt like this huge, as ever, a conversation about fat people without fat people's participation. Yeah. Even the quote unquote fat person involved was not someone, again, like I would read as a fat person.
And also like somebody using your body for like content, like to get clicks on the internet, I would feel really uncomfortable with that.
Yes. Well, this I did remember from at the time. I went to his curvy wife's blog. And one of the first posts that I saw when I was there, I ended up writing about it at one point because it bothered me so much, was one of her first posts there was about this idea of like, you aren't fat, you have fat. You also have fingernails, you aren't fingernails, which is one of those things that is very empowering or feels very empowering to people who are not fat and have not worn plus sizes usually, because it distances them from fatness and fat people.
Right.
Right. The idea is other people are fat. You've seen really fat people. You aren't fat. You have fat. It's a temporary state of being. So you definitely don't need to align yourself with a community. You definitely don't need to defend other people who are perceived as fat.
Right.
People who are perceiving you as fat are wrong. And therefore their criticism of you and their treatment of you shouldn't land. Not they're being dicks and they should stop being dicks.
Right.
Which is the answer.
It's like anti-solidarity. Right. Instead of saying like, there's this whole category of people that I belong to and like, hey, there's other people in this category that are hurting and need your attention. It's like, oh, that's not a real category.
Yeah. And like, that's going to feel shitty to people who are part of that group and who don't really have a pathway out the way that you do. Right. Like I could say all day long, I am not fat. I have fat. And that would not change the way that my doctor treats me. That would not change the way that I'm treated when I get on a plane. That would not change anything. This is a solution for people for whom their own mindset about their bodies is like the main issue.
Yeah.
Which is also feels really frustrating because it's also a reminder of like how much thin people will center themselves no matter fucking what in conversations about fatness and fat people. Not only will they center themselves, they will fully drown out fat people, which is what happened in this case, right?
Right.
Here is a question I have for you. For the AMA, what has been each of your favorite episodes to research for? Was there anything interesting or surprising you didn't get to discuss for those episodes?
Ooh, you go first.
My favorite bar none, no question, absolute greatest was Snake Oil.
Yeah, you loved that one. You were glowing the whole time.
I loved Snake Oil so much. And we recorded for like 3+ hours on that episode.
And
there were so, I didn't really totally understand yet. It was early on enough that I didn't quite know how to structure the story. And there were a bunch of little like tails hanging off of it, you know, that we ended up needing to cut because they were sort of roads to nowhere. I will say the amount of fuckery.
Yeah.
White people dressing up as Native people to sell, to sort of like resell indigenous medicine back to white people.
Yeah.
I could yell about that for hours. And in this case, I did.
Yes.
How about you? What have been some of your favorites to research? Oof.
I think the one, the deepest rabbit hole I went down was Brian Wansink.
Yeah.
There was all the statistical debunking, which like most of the episode focused on. But once you start reading this guy's studies, they're just like so, they're so bad. And you find like breathless pop coverage of them. So one that we didn't talk about, remember how Brian Wansink had this whole thing that like the portions of joy of cooking recipes are going up over time, like larger portions is like how he explained the quote unquote obesity epidemic.
Mm.
So he had a study where they looked at Renaissance paintings and they compared the size of people's heads to the size of the plates in front of them, right? Because oftentimes it's like a dinner scene or something. And they showed that fucking plates had gotten bigger from like the year 1000 until, they said until like 2002 or something. But I'm like, what paintings are you looking at from like recent history? And it was one of those ones where like there's an Atlantic article about it. There's like various pop write-ups of this article as like, did you know portions were getting bigger? And it's like, you have got to be kidding me. Like, it's not, there's no statistical mumbo jumbo. Like, he didn't fake any of the data, but it's just an absurd concept, the idea that paintings would reflect reality.
Yeah.
People make stylistic decisions about where they place characters and how big their plates are, etc. So it's like, the fact that plates were bigger in paintings does not remotely mean that they were bigger in real life. It's just like a fundamentally absurd study that got published somehow and also got a ton of pop coverage. And I was like, man, I gotta cram this in. And I just couldn't, like, I could not find an excuse to talk about it.
Also just like, I don't know, man, like in what fucking context are these all individual plates? There are things called serving platters. There are like places in the fucking world. There's like Ethiopian food where everyone eats off of one big plate. There's like, right. Do you know what I mean? I'm just like, what are we doing here?
Also, like sometimes you go over to somebody's house and they have like really big plates, but like it doesn't mean you necessarily eat more. It's like a stylistic thing.
Sure.
To like make the food look cool, right?
Charger plates are a whole thing. You don't even eat off of them. They're just sort of there for decoration. Yeah.
So like at the most basic level, it just doesn't make any sense. And I'm always amazed. I'm like, there must have been like 50 or 60 people who saw this at various stages of the editorial process, right? And like, no one was just like, this is fucking stupid and shouldn't be published.
No one had seen Semi-Homemade with Sandra Lee, where she does tablescapes. Andrew Cuomo's ex, Sandra Lee. Bring it on home. Make it as cursed as possible. So I'm going to, is it okay if I read off our next question?
Yeah, do it, do it.
How has this show changed your perspectives? Does it play out at all in your day-to-day life? And this person wrote, especially for Mike. You're in the hot seat, bud.
People know the score. The growth on this show is from me. The person that needs to do the most growth. I think that's
fair. I got plenty of growth to do myself, bud. Don't count yourself out there.
Well, I don't know if I've ever told you this, but before we recorded our Shallow Hal episode, I listened to 4 other podcasts that were like reviews of Shallow Hal and came to the same conclusions as us, which is that it's total trash. Mm. And one thing that was so interesting recording the show with you is that you had insights on that movie and you brought up things that I had never heard before.
Mm.
Like that scene where he's asking Gwyneth Paltrow out on a date in like a douchey way. And it's like, the audience knows she's fat, but like, we don't know she's fat or whatever that miserable joke was. The store owner comes by and it's like, excuse me, miss, is this gentleman bothering you? And You said the central fakeness of that scene wasn't even the concept of the movie. It was that people do not do that for fat people. People do not say, like, excuse me, is this person bothering you?
Pardon me, how can I help you, fat person? Is, like, not exactly a thing that has existed in my life as a fat person.
You had so many other great insights during that episode. You had so many other great insights during the, like, 50 podcasts that we've recorded together. It's so edifying and, like, intellectually nutritious to learn about, like, the ways that you're not seeing the world.
Yeah.
And that has been the biggest thing about doing this show is that, like, you know, I've come to feel very strongly that my perspectives on the world are affected by my thinness as much as, like, fat people's perspectives on the world are affected by their fatness. Yeah. Like, there's this idea that you can't consult a fat person for your scare story about the obesity epidemic because, like, oh, fat people can't talk about this because, like, oh, they have a dog in this fight, right? Like, they're fundamentally not going to give you an objective opinion, whereas, like, oh, well, you can talk to a thin person about it because, like, a thin person, that's the default, right? Like, we're just talking about the science.
Yeah.
But thin people have just as much of a fucking dog in this fight as fat people do. And, like, in the same way that my perspective on the world is affected by my whiteness and by my Americanness and all these other things, it's also affected by my thinness. And I think that's just that it's the same lesson, but I just keep learning it over and over again recording this podcast with you.
That is absolutely how I have come to this project largely, is, like, there are so many fucking thin people out in the world being total gremlins to fat people, right? Who, like, genuinely think they're doing good and helpful things when they go, hey, have you tried this diet? Hey, do you want a gym buddy? Hey, do you want a bubble? Right? Like, all of that sort of stuff is rooted in this misperception. Sometimes it's genuine and good faith. Sometimes it's fucking not, that they're, like, helping fat people. That's the idea. And yeah. I think there's, like, not really a lot of sort of, like, popular media that has tried to unpack that kind of intent versus impact stuff around fatness, right?
Do you have in your brain a list of, like, the most irritating microaggressions? Do you have, like, a top five?
I mean, I feel like the biggest fucking one is unsolicited weight loss advice.
Yeah.
I mean, like, so much of it is rooted in this idea of every fat person is trying to be thin at every moment of their lives.
Yeah.
They're failing. You can see that on their bodies. They need help. I'm an expert because I'm not fat. Therefore, they need me to reach down to them and pull them out of the muck and mire of fatness.
Yeah.
And, like, realize their potential as thin people. It's extremely, extremely common. It's sort of the default way of thinking and talking about fatness and fat people from a thin perspective in this world. And it is astonishingly condescending.
Yeah.
And really, really painful to be on the receiving end. Again, speaking only for myself here, really, really painful to be on the receiving end of someone who is telling you, I'm better than you, so I'm going to teach you about all of these ways that you have failed that you didn't know you had failed.
Yeah.
I assume you don't know that you're fat, so I'm going to first tell you that you're fat, and then I'm going to tell you how to fix that because it needs fixing. I don't personally begrudge folks for having picked up that script. It's everywhere, but I want them to stop.
Have the tone and tenor of those conversations changed over time? Like, was this different 10 years ago than it is now?
I don't know, and I don't know that I'm a good barometer of that.
Okay.
Because that is a perspective of someone who in that 5 to 10 years has become a public figure speaking about this stuff. So I just experience it really differently.
Right.
And it's also, like, that's a weird time to become a public figure, right? Like, we've been in quarantine when I, like, said what my name was and showed what my face looked like and showed up on camera and all of those sorts of things, like, all happened while we were in a pandemic. Anyway, that's neither here nor there.
This is extremely here and there because this is our next question. This is, how did it feel to share your identity after only being known as your fat friend?
It was scary for a lot of reasons. I think there were a lot of people in my personal life who didn't know that this was what I was doing.
There were, like, you had coworkers and stuff that didn't know you had this, like, alter ego on the internet?
Nobody that I worked with knew.
Oh, wow. So how did they react?
I got a range of reactions, I will say. Some folks were like, this is great. I'm so glad you're doing it. And other folks would say things like, I heard you on the radio today. You've got such a great voice. and I was like, oh, you don't want to engage with some subject matter here. I got you.
That's microaggression number two. We're building the list.
Okay, so our next two questions are sort of related. The first one is, are there any topics you shelved because they were too sensitive for either of you personally? The second one is, have you ever had an idea for an episode that you thought would be fun, but upon closer inspection turned out to be a huge bummer or just too gross to cover. I don't know about too gross, but like there are definitely things that we've talked about but not made into episodes.
Yeah, I want to hear this from you because you chose these questions.
Yeah,
so
I did.
What was the one that came immediately to mind?
We have gotten on the like what's too close to you personally end. We have gotten really a lot of requests for stuff around pregnancy and fertility and sort of the weight bias that happens there. That is a thing that is way too close to home for me, not because I'm like a parent or I'm rearing any children. I'm not doing either of those things, but because it relates for me back to like hard medical mistreatment as a result of being a fat person. I've had some sort of like fertility related stuff to that, that I like for sure don't want to talk about. but that means I'm probably not going to make that episode. I totally hear folks that is a thing that they would like to hear. And yeah. I don't think I'm in a place to give it, you know?
Yeah.
I don't think I'm in a place to give it.
It also sounds like I shouldn't do an episode related to that stuff either. Cause it's going to be a huge bummer for you.
It would bum me out.
It's like the thing on Friends where you get a freebie. You get to like sleep with one other person, you know? It's like if we each get three topics that it's like you're not allowed to do.
Oh my God.
I'm just like veto.
I just literally yesterday for research watched the Fat Monica episode of Friends.
Oh, really? Ooh, condolences.
It's so rough, buddy. It's so rough. Yeah. And then the other one that came up for, is there an episode that we thought would be fun, but there just wasn't any there is more, I think more frequently for me, it's that I get an idea and I start to look into it and I'm like, oh, there's not really a story here.
Wait, so which one was it?
I had this idea. You rightfully gave me some shit about it at the time.
What?
But
what
I like pitched an idea. This was like a year ago or something where I was like, here's what I want to do. I want to look at salads. How did salads become an entree food? How did they become so gendered? How did they become so racialized? Like, what happened with salads that has become the stand-in for, like, healthy food?
I don't remember this conversation, honestly. What
no,
is, what
I don't
was the
know why you would. Oh, you were just like, I'm sure you'll be reading through a lot of undergraduate theses for research. And I was like, correct.
Yeah.
But that's one where I'm like, that's a thing that I find interesting. I haven't found roots of a story to grab onto there.
Wait, so I think salads might be one of my freebies because the only reason I can think of that I wouldn't want to do an episode on salads is that like I really don't like salads and I don't want to like offend the salad people because it's going to hurt people's feelings.
The salad community.
Yeah. Salads are fine. Salads are great. If I eat a salad, I'm hungry 20 minutes later. So I don't eat a lot of salads because then I have to eat again.
I personally enjoy a salad, but I like a Cobb salad.
Yeah, that's
where it's
too.
Sort of like they opened up a sandwich and now it's a salad. Do you know what I mean?
I need like I need like a can of tuna on top of it, whatever it is. Put a can of tuna on it and then I'm fine.
That's right.
But yeah, that's the only reason I can think of that I would have objected to a salads episode.
No, mostly you were just like, this is very funny. It's very you. To me, right? That you were like, this is very Aubrey, that you would be like, I'm going to trace the cultural roots of salads. Like, yes, check.
Let's do one last fun one.
Ooh.
To circle back to the beginning, what do you do to get cozy when settling in for a long research session, Aubrey?
So I get on the couch all curled up with my dog. Mm-hmm. And what I usually do is start by pulling together a research list of like, here are all the sources I'm going to consult. So I've got all the links in one place.
You do that.
And then I go through each of those studies or stories or whatever and click a bunch of referral links to sort of like chase down the stories behind the stories, right? And keep notes and then organize them into a show notes document. And I usually do that with, again, just with like a throw blanket and my dog and sometimes a cup of mint tea or citrus chamomile. Those are my favorites.
What's the music situation?
Same as when I'm writing, which is either a film score of some kind or a number of different music streaming services have playlists called Classical Chill.
Okay. Yeah, I know those.
And
yeah.
It's basically like classical music so that you don't get like Ride of the Valkyries thrown in there.
Right. It's not marching band, loud brass, percussive.
Yeah, you're not
brass.
Getting John Philip Sousa in there. yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And sometimes, depending on the research, I might have like TV on in the background just because I have a thing about not being in a silent room while I'm working.
Okay.
How about you?
When we first started this, we were like talking about what topics we could do, and you sent me a number of like research lists. You're like, oh, like I had to think about it, and like here's a bunch of sources for this episode. And then I think over time you realize that like my process is much more chaotic. Uh-huh. I don't have like uh-huh. I'm gonna systematically make a list of sources and then read all of the sources. Like I don't remotely do that. I just open a million tabs.
Gotcha. You also have a monster notes document and then a separate organized one, right?
No, I have one big document where I put everything, but then I condense it. So before we record, I usually have like 100-130 pages or something of notes. And like, yeah, some of it's junk. Some of it, it's like paragraphs pasted from various sources and stuff. And so I'll go through and I'll condense it down because as we learned in the Rachel Hollis episode, I can only really get through like 40 pages of notes in a recording session. So I have to make it 40 pages before we record. So I'm like, okay, I'm not going to go down that weird digressionary path. I'm not going to mention this study. I've gotten better about doing that. I used to just be like, I'll just have 100 pages when I talk to Aubrey and I'll be fine.
Yeah.
And I'm like rushing through it.
This is me with the snake oil episode.
Yeah. It's, I think we both like honed this down a little bit.
What about getting cozy? What do you do to get cozy?
I have a playlist called Work Pretty, which is a bunch of droning, like think Sigur Rós, but like you run out of Sigur Rós eventually, but like for like 12 minutes. Fucking love it.
Delightful.
I just want to feel like I'm listening to a fax machine for the entire time.
You want to hear that AOL sound?
Yeah, exactly.
Okay, so here's my last fun one. You ready?
Sure.
What are you both reading right now?
And that was my other fun one.
Was it?
Yeah, it's really good.
So I'll say, I am currently reading two things. I just finished a gigantic deadline, so I'm very excited to read about anything other than like peer-reviewed studies about fat people and fatness and weight loss and blah, blah, blah. So I'm reading two things right now. Mm-hmm. The one that is my interest anyway is called The End of Bias, A Beginning. And it's a roundup of the sort of science and praxis of like, what does it look like to actually tackle implicit and explicit bias? And it's a rundown of like all of this political research and all of this scientific research and all of this sort of stuff. It's really well done. And the one that I'm reading just for funsies is Samantha Irby posted about this particular essay collection. And I was like, this is extremely my fucking speed. It is an essay collection by someone named Rax King. And it's called Tacky, Love Letters to the Worst Culture We Have to Offer.
Ooh, that does sound very Aubrey.
It's so great. So there's like a whole essay about the menu at the Cheesecake Factory. There's a whole essay about Guy Fieri. There's a whole essay about Jersey Shore. There's one called You Want to Be on Top about America's Next Top Model.
Hell yeah.
Anyway, it's like very fun and meaningful.
Yes.
And I really like it.
Many people talked during Game of Thrones about how far more people watch WWE every week than Game of Thrones. And just like the sheer numbers. And like, quote unquote tacky culture, I feel like has a much larger influence on culture than like elite, quote unquote highbrow culture. Like tacky culture is like where actual culture happens.
I'm like very into this. I started it last night and I'm already like, I'm all in. I love it. Let's go. How about you? What are you reading?
I was also in the same thing. I like, I need to read something that is like not current events.
Yep.
And so I went on the library website and I looked at all the audiobooks that were available. And I was like, science.
Mm.
Sciencey stuff, completely other. And I found this book from 2018 called The Rise and Fall of the Dinosaurs.
Oh.
And I got the audiobook and it's fucking lit. It's like exactly what it sounds like. It's just like what everything we've learned about the dinosaurs in like basically the 30 years since Jurassic Park came out, because there's this whole generation of paleontologists that have gotten really into the field as a result of Jurassic Park. And there's all this new interest and they're like, they're naming a new species of dinosaur every week, Aubrey.
What?
It's like Xanadu in the field right now. It's so cool. And we're finding out about all these like mass extinctions we didn't know about and species we didn't know about and like why, like how the T-Rex became a thing and like, oh, it's so good. Anyway, highly recommended. I blasted through it in like a day and a half.
I will say I was, you and I talked about this at one point. I was watching QI. Do you ever watch QI?
Are you kidding me? Aubrey.
I mean, it seems so fucking on brand for both Aubrey. You and I.
Stephen Fry and fun facts. Yes.
So QI did a whole episode where they were talking about how all of our drawings about dinosaurs might be wrong.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. Because they're feathers. They're all feathered.
Because a bunch of them are feathered. They've essentially like dressed up skeletons and assumed dinosaurs were pretty much just the shape of their skeletons. And one of the things that they brought up on the show is they were like, you never see a fat dinosaur.
Yeah.
We didn't imagine them as being fat. We didn't imagine them as having any kind of like weight accumulated outside of their skeletons. And I was like, that's fascinating. I have also never thought about a fat dinosaur. I love this. Thank you, Sammy Toksvig.
Let's trade books.
Let's trade books. I would love to read your dinosaur book.
And then we'll do an episode about tacky dinosaurs, and we can both talk about our passions.